This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Coming up on the program today, some banking, some taxes, self-driving cars, and cooking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 7th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there was a time in this economy back before the financial crisis when bank mergers were all the rage. One big bank buying up another big bank until we wound up with a whole lot of ever bigger banks. Since the crisis, though, not so much. A whole lot of smaller banks have merged, but the biggies, yeah, kind of tumbleweeds. Until today, BB&T and SunTrust, two of the biggest regional banks in this economy, announced the biggest bank merger since the financial crisis this morning, an all-stock deal worth $28 billion. It's going to create the sixth largest consumer bank in the country because, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, now more than ever before, size matters.
As BB&T and SunTrust have grown, they've gotten closer to hitting a regulatory tipping point, $250 billion in assets. At that size, banks have faced more government oversight. Recently, though, the Trump administration loosened the rules and compliance costs for banks with up to $700 billion in assets, which is where the merged bank would land, says Greg McBride at Bankrate.com.
Lifting the asset threshold at which banks have to undergo more stringent stress tests, stricter regulation, has opened the door to mergers between regional institutions.
Which he says they need to do to go up against the trillion-dollar banks like JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America. And banks big and small have to worry about competition from financial technology, says Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics. Think PayPal, Apple Pay, Google Wallet, and whatever Amazon or Facebook might come up with.
All banks need to get ready for that disruption. But it takes a lot of technology investment, and the bigger the bank, the easier that is.
The merger will likely be good for the banks, but not their employees, says Bartlett Naylor at Public Citizen. Combined, they have 3,100 branches in the Southeast.
You're going to have two people doing the same job, and one of them is going to lose it.
Naylor warns that more consolidation could leave consumers with fewer banking choices, lower interest on deposits, and higher service fees. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
British Prime Minister Theresa May was in Brussels today, again, trying to convince the European Union, again, to reopen negotiations on the terms for Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. Said Ms. May, "I am clear that I am going to deliver Brexit. I am going to deliver it on time." Her EU hosts were noncommittal, we should say. Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains how this is all going to play out.
I've been covering this story for 2.5 years now, every twist and turn of it, and I have to tell you, I have no idea what happens next, and I very much doubt anyone else does either. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Yes, I know we ran that same piece like 10 days ago. That is kind of the point with this story. All right, back to reality. We are 10 days into tax filing season, the first, as you know, under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. That was, of course, a federal law that changed the federal tax code. But as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, it is causing all sorts of problems in some states.
Most states link up their tax systems with the federal tax code in some way. Richard Auchscher at the Tax Policy Center says that makes filing simpler for taxpayers. And it's a good deal for the states.
They also get to use the IRS for administration purposes. They get to use federal courts. They get to use a bunch of that administrative work that the federal government is doing.
But when Congress changes the federal tax code, as it just did, that can create problems for states. For instance, the new federal tax law got rid of certain deductions. It made up for that by cutting tax rates. So overall, most people still got a tax cut. Now take the state of Arizona. Every year, it decides whether to link up with federal tax law. Usually, it uses federal deductions, but has its own tax rates. So this year, if the state doesn't cut its tax rates too, its residents are going to be left with higher taxes. The state hasn't decided what to do, and in the meantime, the revenue department took a guess at what's going to happen and sent out tax forms.
So now you have people in Arizona using forms that don't represent current law.
Those taxpayers are going to start getting refunds. And Brandon Harbeck, an accountant in Arizona, says if the state decides to adjust its tax rates, it might have to recalculate what it owes people. Or
there is a potential that, you know, you would have to file an amended return and pay the difference in your tax liability. It wouldn't be happy for anybody involved.
Some states that haven't figured things out yet are trying to avoid the headache, like Virginia. It's gotten more than 300,000 tax returns and just hasn't processed them yet. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the trade war jitters are back. Comments from the White House that President Trump and Chinese President Xi probably are not going to meet face-to-face before the March 1st deadline Mr. Trump has set for the next phase in his trade war. Red ink all the way around on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Instacart, the online grocery delivery company, ran headlong into two phenomena of the modern digital economy this week. Number one, social media outrage over its pay policies, namely using tips that customers give to basically subsidize the pay the company gives its workers. And number two, the reality that the gig economy is changing a whole lot of rules. For the second time in less than a week, Instacart has raised wages as things heat up in the increasingly competitive online delivery market. Marketplace's Renata Sago explains what's going on.
Vanessa Bain was making decent money 3 years ago when she started picking up fruits, vegetables, and other grocery items for Instacart customers in California. She'd walk into a Costco
and know for a fact that I would be paid no less than $30, $40, $50 to do a couple of orders there.
Tips were generous, and she got paid per order. But she says in recent months, her wages have plunged. It can take her fulfilling three times as many orders to make just $10.
Those are the going rates right now.
Last week, in response to social media protests, Instacart announced it would guarantee a $3 minimum for delivery. And this week, a new minimum wage sliding scale was introduced, $5 to $10, depending on the job. That's welcome news for Bain and other workers, but it's just a tiny step ahead for an online food delivery industry that's struggling to make a profit. Rachel Lauder runs Working Washington. She says the big issue with the gig economy is the actual gig payment.
When investors are making decisions, are they considering workers' conditions? Their wages aren't sufficient. There's no transparency in their pay models and that their pay changes all the time.
And food delivery workers usually aren't able to charge a premium on their services, like ride-sharing drivers, for example. Bill Bishop with the consulting firm Brick Meets Click says maybe a different pricing model is needed.
The payment could be directly related to the number of items in the basket.
Or maybe surge pricing for peak delivery times. One thing's for sure, other online food delivery companies are now looking to figure this out. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
We started doing a thing a couple of months ago on the program, calling listeners to talk about prices in this economy, inflation, in other words, as it begins to tick up. And we wanted to know what they might, as consumers, decide at some point to do without instead of just paying more for what they usually buy. Lots has happened since the last time we reached out. The romaine lettuce recall, wildfires, winter storms, of course, the government shutdown. So here you go, the latest installment here of what some consumers have decided is their pricing breaking point.
I change a lot of my buying habits based on what the prices of things are. Especially being in the middle of the country, things like produce are harder to find and more expensive than they were when we were in Colorado or California. Olivia wanted raspberries at the grocery store last weekend, and I told her that we only buy them when they're on sale because I won't spend more than $2.50 per pint on berries.
Sensodyne toothpaste, as weird as that sounds, I go to Costco and buy about 5 tubes, and it's about $22, $23, which I feel like isn't too bad. It's one of the things that I do buy in bulk because it just becomes a little more cost effective. It's one of those trade-offs that I've made to, you know, spend a little more in one place because it really feels like it makes a difference.
I was kind of surprised when I was replacing romaine. I was just finding other lettuces, and they were marking a lot of lettuces down, like really, really cheap, you know, so that people would buy them, I guess. But then when the romaine came back, everything was actually even more expensive, possibly. I did notice that some of the Northern California wines that they ship here were just a little bit more expensive than they used to be. It made me shop around a little bit more for different wines that I wasn't particularly familiar with because I thought, well, they're bound to be just as good. They're still in my old price range.
I think we had talked about film. Photography is a hobby of mine. I'm a federal employee in Chicago. And during the shutdown, I really had to take to heart what I was going to buy because we just didn't know when we were going to get paid. I knew I didn't need the film, so I didn't look for it. As far as groceries, I just, whenever I went to the store, I made sure that, you know, I just bought the stuff that I needed and be done with it.
That was Kelsey Sproul in Iowa City, Kelly Kaletsky in Columbus, Ohio, Ellen Murphy from Mission Hills, Kansas, also Ernesto from Chicago. Didn't want us to use his last name. Quick scan of the headlines coming out of Washington leads one to believe that the odds of a second government shutdown a week from tomorrow are fading. Optimism seems to be the order of the day. The 35 days that the government was shut down last month, though, are lingering in this economy. The vast majority of the 800,000 government workers affected by it have gotten their back pay. But missing two paychecks forced a lot of them to tap into their savings or take out loans. Others got unemployment benefits they now have to pay back. And as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, a lot of those workers are worried about lingering debt.
Every month, 33-year-old Robert Litterman logs onto a government website and withdraws his $4,500 in monthly pay. He has a National Science Foundation grant that covers his work as an evolutionary biologist at the University of Rhode Island. So basically, he cuts his own paycheck. He wasn't expecting the partial federal shutdown.
I would have pulled down more had I known.
Because with the shutdown, the website where he gets his money was also shut down. At first,
we did nothing. We paid bills as they came due in their full amount.
There were utilities, groceries, and daycare to pay for, holiday spending, and gas to get to work. Before the shutdown, Litterman and his wife had little debt, and they were working towards having none. But as the shutdown dragged on, they started paying their expenses with their credit cards.
I mean, so we're up to the gills on a lot of this, and we'll be able to pay some of it down. But it's basically going to just reset everything that we had worked towards.
Litterman got paid this week, and now he has a choice to make. Either pay down a little of his debt and save some money for a rainy day, or pay all of it and save nothing. Bruce McClary with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling says borrowing money, even to fill short-term gaps, can be
the beginning of a slippery slope in terms of the damage that can do to somebody's financial situation.
Especially during an emergency.
Oftentimes people overlook some of the finer details of what they're getting into.
McClary says chances are about a third of shutdown borrowers will carry some of the debt they accrued into the future, especially if they already had debt.
And it just makes it more difficult to regain your footing and return to a point where you're financially stable.
And even when workers receive all of their back pay, they may not immediately clear debts or replace savings. Bridget Madrian, a behavioral economist at Brigham Young University, says studies show that people tend not to pay down their debts, even if they can. That's because
people tend to be overly optimistic about, you know, what types of things might befall them in life.
Even if they've just gone through a difficult period, like the shutdown. As for Robert Litterman, this week he took advantage of the fact that his National Science Foundation grant lets him take his salary whenever he wants to. He paid himself not just for this month, but for next month too. And
if the rumblings in the air seem worse, I'll probably take the rest. There's really no upside or downside to either way. The money just sits in my account or their account. So
that way, if the government shuts down again, he at least won't have to go without a salary. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
By now, I have not made the very relevant distinction that they're actually not called comments. They're called notes.
And they're nice, too. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 0.8% today, 220 points, 25,169. The NASDAQ shed 1.1%, 86 points, 7,288. The S&P 500 down 0.9%, 25 points, 2,706. Even though profits soared in the latest quarter, Twitter stock got hammered today. It lost nearly 10%. Other social media companies down as well. Snap off 0.25%. Facebook down 2.4% today. You heard Mitchell talking about BB&T's acquisition of SunTrust earlier. Shares of both banks significantly higher today. BB&T rose 3.9%. SunTrust brightened at 10.1%. Some of the biggies, though, they were down. Citi off 1.6%, Wells Fargo down 2.3%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For all the promise of driverless cars, we are still not quite there. There was a pedestrian fatality last year. You might remember she was hit and killed by an autonomous vehicle. The technology is really hard, the experts tell us. It could take decades to perfect. But it's good enough right now to let entrepreneurs start rolling out some driverless services, kind of a taste test. They, of course, want to control the risks as much as possible, keeping speed and geography and weather as constant as they can, which explains why Phoenix, Arizona is an autonomous vehicle hotspot. Marketplace's Scott Tong took a couple of demo models for a driverless spin.
Imagine your Uber pulls up without a driver. That's what the company Waymo is trying to pull off. It has a fleet of Chrysler minivans loaded up with sensors and cameras, taking passengers around the Phoenix suburb of Chandler. I hop in the back seat of one, and the car talks.
Hang tight while we figure this out.
For now, there's a safety driver at the wheel, just in case. But he doesn't touch anything as we pull out of a parking lot, and the steering wheel steers itself.
My initial reaction was, nah, that's not really happening.
That's Damian Nichols, a paying customer with the Waymo app. He's in the back with me.
You know, I had to do a double take because you're like, is somebody really touching those pedals? But they're not.
He's an IT guy, one of several hundred guinea pig customers picked by Waymo. In front of us, there's a monitor giving a digital 360 view of everything the car is seeing.
All of those blue boxes are the vehicles. If you see a person, there'll be a little round circle.
Ooh, first big test, a harrowing left turn onto a busy road.
This is the tricky part. You can see right now a truck turning in front of us, another one going, and the Waymo van just waiting. It's monitoring traffic in both directions, and when it's clear, like right now, here we go, left turn.
It drives amazingly smooth. If anything, too cautious. At stop signs and school zones, it's like a robot with a learner's permit. But to Nichols, Waymo has improved on a year ago.
When it would counter a bicycle rider on the side of the road, it would slow down drastically and try to deal with what was going on. Now you really don't see that often.
Waymo is cheaper than Uber, and it's Nichols' rideshare of choice now. He rides at least once a week to eat out. Even his teenage kids take Waymo. The company's goal, of course, is to get rid of that expensive safety driver. That's key to its business model, says engineering prof Matthew Johnson Roberson at the University of Michigan.
If you can eliminate the driver in a robo-taxi, you have this incredible economic opportunity to decrease the cost of ride-sharing.
But the technology's not there yet. Last year, there was the pedestrian fatality.
We're coming to grips with the fact that it can't do everything that we had originally thought, but it can do certain things really well. And if we figure out sort of where the sweet spot is, where do we meet in the middle?
Sweet spots where today's technology, warts and all, is trusted and accepted by paying customers. Another startup in the Phoenix area is Nuro. It's built a teeny tiny van with a minimalist design. No steering wheel, no pedals, no seats. It's a self-driving delivery mobile. Right now, en route to web developer David Meacham's house.
It looks like a friendly little, almost something that I could imagine in like a Pixar movie.
Since December, Nuro and a local supermarket have joined forces. For $6, anyone in this zip code can order groceries and have Nuro deliver.
Oh, whoa, 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 whoa.
Oh, here the little baby car is.
Oh, the most adorable car is coming with our food.
Vehicle stops, Meacham approaches, and punches in a code.
Opening doors.
Automatic door opening. Take out all of our groceries.
And bam, that's it. The Nuro car drives on local streets, but never over 25 miles per hour. Johnson Roberson says that's a good thing.
Your groceries don't care really how long it takes to get there. You have a lot more freedom to take safer routes, and so the likelihood that you're going to cause a fatal accident is much lower.
He thinks 2019 will bring lots of experimental driverless trials to American consumers. As far as Nuro's delivery car,
time to go. Doors are closing.
One odd thing. It's old school side mirrors that serve no purpose except to meet safety regulations. These robo-cars, bunch of rule followers. In Scottsdale, Arizona, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It's not often you hear that the comments section on a particular website is a highlight, but that is exactly how said section on the New York Times cooking website has been described. NYT Cooking separated from the core website back in 2014 as a place where readers could find all of the recipes published in the paper over the years. It went digital subscription only in 2017. Allison Herman wrote about NYT Cooking for The Ringer in a piece called How NYT Cooking Became the Best Comment Section on the Internet. Allison, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's cut to the chase. Why is the New York Times cooking section comments, why are they the best on the internet?
Well, there's a few factors, but I think the biggest one is just the subject matter. I think most of the time when you leave a comment on the internet, you're just kind of airing your opinion mostly for your own benefit, maybe for the writer of the story, but not really many other people. But with cooking, there's a tangible goal and takeaway, and everyone is kind of working towards that goal together. So the fact that there is a practical application for the comment section that everyone has relevant experience with, if the moderators are doing their job right, I think that really makes a difference.
As you said, this is it is curated, it is moderated, and the definer is, according to the New York Times cooking app, you have to have made the recipe or show you've made the recipe, right? You can't just be willy-nilly saying, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah, and the fact that they regularly and pretty strictly enforce that, I think, has a lot to do with how healthy the community is there. Like, you have to submit a comment for approval, and even if the comment is, you know, funny or innocuous, but it doesn't have anything to do with the recipe at hand or your experience with it, they'll unfortunately have to turn you down.
So well diplomatically said. I think that's fascinating. You spoke to Sam Sifton, the guy who runs this site for the New York Times. In fact, started, right, cooking for the New York Times?
Yes, he's the former restaurant reviewer as well.
He is deliberate about this. He acknowledges that it's part of the business appeal of this part of the New York Times, right?
Yes. And he will actually, if he listens to this, probably be frustrated that by now I have not made the very relevant distinction that they're actually not called comments. They're called notes, which he believes makes a huge difference in the tone of the discussion.
Well, first of all, Sam's a listener. We happen to know that, and we've had him on. So, Sam, how are you? But also explain the difference between notes and comments.
I believe the distinction that he made was that comments are exactly what I described earlier. They're mostly opinion, they're mostly feedback, and notes have a much more direct relationship to what is being annotated. And, you know, they're little tweaks or adjustments. They have to do with amending the material as opposed to kind of supplementing it with your own take on it.
Were this not the New York Times, it would be a different situation, right? Because the Times, as we know from their earnings report the other day, is doing really well. Their digital products are doing really well. So they can afford to have people sitting there curating, actual human people sitting there curating these comments.
Yeah, and I think it definitely signals their priority. But also, yeah, I mentioned this in the piece, but moderation's a little bit of a dying art. Either it's outsourced or it's automated, so a comment automatically gets rejected if it has a swear word. But it's very rare that it's as deliberate and as much of a clear, intentional focus as it is at the Times.
Yeah. You're a user, clearly, of these comments. Are you a commenter?
I am not, but my father, if he is listening to this and whose subscription I mooch off of, is.
Oh, man. Well, let's hope your dad's listening. Allison Herman at The Ringer, writing about the New York Times cooking section comments. Allison, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, in which it turns out central bankers do have a sense of humor. Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, held a press conference today. He was asked, among many other things, if he ever woke up in the morning regretting that he had agreed to extend his term, given the mess that is Brexit. And I should say here, the bank's latest forecast has UK economic growth falling from 1.7% to 1.2%, and that's if everything goes smoothly Brexit-wise. Anyway, Carney said, yeah, no, he's not waking up in the morning with regrets. He's waking up in the middle of the night. I mean, he was laughing, but still, right? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 0.8% today, 220 points. NASDAQ down 1.1%. That is 86 points. The S&P 500 down 0.9%, 25 points. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron McKella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.